What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
This is Josh Marshall, and this is the Josh Marshall Podcast with Kate Riga. Today, we are going to talk about a range of topics, but almost all of them come back to the central issue of abortion and abortion rights. But a lot of it will be on the electoral dimensions of the question. And, you know, as we know, the policy and the political and the personal dimensions of this are always part of the politics. But in this set of issues, in this set of topics we're going to talk about today, it's going to lean more in that direction. And we're just going to jump right into it here. The first thing we're going to talk about, you've probably seen this, that the Florida Supreme Court, which is one of these extremely stacked Supreme Courts in the country, you know, Florida's had, I feel like Lawton Chiles was the last Democratic governor of Florida. I'm pretty sure I'm right about that. And that was back in the late 90s. Cause you know, you had Jeb, and then you had Charlie Crist. And then you had the guy who became senator, Rick Scott, and then you had DeSantis. So basically, you know, Florida hasn't had a Democratic governor in sort of like modern political history, basically, I think even in the 21st century. So you got a totally stacked Supreme Court, state Supreme Court. And few days ago, they came out with a few different decisions. The upshot of all of them was to say, okay, we're good to go with the 6-week abortion ban, A, but we're also good to go with putting ballot initiatives on the November ballot, which will let voters decide whether they want abortion rights in the state. And the second one really surprised a lot of people. The actual, there's not normally a system, you know, the state Supreme Court is not in charge of ballot initiatives. So that's not the system. So what happened here was the state attorney general, and again, everybody statewide in Florida is a Republican, and in the sort of the nature of things, a fairly extreme Republican, or at least hyper-partisan Republican. Not always exactly the same thing. The state attorney general sued and basically said, I mean, I think this is why the suit didn't work. She basically said, this is so weird, you can't do it. I mean, that was basically the argument. I think technically it was like, this ballot initiative is going to have all these implications that voters can't possibly understand. I mean, it basically had that level of jurisprudential logic to it. So the state, but again, stacked state Supreme Court. So I think a lot of people thought they might say, you know, sounds good to us. We can't do this, but they didn't. The state Supreme Court okayed this ballot initiative and also another ballot initiative for marijuana legalization in the state. So this is going to be on the ballot. And that is potentially both a big deal for reproductive rights in Florida and maybe a big deal for the 2024 election in general. Now, there's a couple very big caveats to this. And the first one, probably the biggest, is that in Florida, I believe since 2007, you need 60% of the vote for one of these initiatives to pass. And that in this context, that is not just another 10%. That's a critical 10% for this issue, abortion rights specifically. We've had a number of these ballot referendums, initiatives, propositions in red or reddish states around the country. And generally speaking, they get up into the high 50s%. I believe the one in Kansas that kind of got the, you know, got the ball rolling with the, you know, the viral abortion initiative trend, as it were, that was 59%. And then the one in Ohio a few months ago was 57%. I think it was actually like 56.6% or something like that. So the point is 60% is a big deal. In red or reddish states, they don't tend to get there. Now, the other way to look at this is that I think there's some question just how red we should think Florida is. I mean, Kansas is obviously a red state. It was a red state before there was even red. I mean, it was founded as a Republican state, literally, and it's sort of always been a Republican state. Ohio is obviously more recent, but Ohio, it's not even close these days in presidential terms. Kate and I were looking at the actual numbers in the last two presidential elections. And in 2016, it was like 1.5 or 1.6. And then in 2020, it was 3.4. Now, I think most Democrats feel like we have just been burned too many times with this Florida thing. Right, too many heartbreaks. We're not playing that game anymore. And that is a very understandable reaction given all that has happened over recent years. But those are still pretty tight margins, and I think we have somewhat overstated the reddishness, you know, based on that. There's other arguments. I mean, one other argument would be look at the trend even between 2016 and 2020. Right? I mean, it expanded. So I'm not saying it's like a break-even state or that Biden's going to win it or something like that. But I think it's, again, it's important for us to step back a little bit from the vibes, which I think are informed by all those heartbreaks, and see that actual presidential elections, statewide elections, have still been relatively close. I think there's another argument that it is, despite being kind of a red trending purple state, it tends to be a little more libertarian-ish than some of those other states. So in any case, it's possible. It's possible, but 60% is a high bar. And then the other factor here, and I think Kate and I have been sort of exchanging slacks about this. We're still trying to get our heads around it, that many of you will remember that back in 2018, Florida had another one of these ballot initiatives, again, for a constitutional amendment, that basically said you're not going to have felon disenfranchisement anymore. And it won. It won with 65% of the vote, which, you know, in any normal election these days, that's absolutely unheard of. You know, nothing ever gets 65% of the vote. And so it went into the Constitution. And then the Florida state legislature basically passed a law that said, okay, not really. And they didn't get rid of the constitutional amendment, but they said, okay, well, yes, there's no more felony disenfranchisement, but if you have any fines or any penalties or anything like that outstanding, you got to pay all those first before you can vote again. And they did other sort of like administrative stuff to make it harder. You know, this was only 6 years ago, so a lot of us will remember it. And it wasn't and still isn't totally clear to me how much maybe the authors of the initiative didn't author it quite tightly enough, you know, to sort of forestall that kind of move that notionally is kind of enabling legislation, but is actually kind of sabotaging legislation. or whether they really had no right to do it, but they own the governor and they own the Supreme Court, so who cares? We'll do whatever we want. What's operative here is that obviously that does cast a bit of a shadow about the potential result of the, not the whole election, but, you know, whatever that ballot initiative or proposition gets. I looked at the language and it does seem to be a little more clear and saying like, you know, no law, no this, no that. And I'm still trying to get a sense whether some of that is that the authors of this, ballot amendment looked at what happened in 2018 and said, look, we're not going to do that. We're going to, you know, we're going to make this a little tighter. So those are still some factual questions that we have. But let's look at both. Kay, what do you think? We've had a few days to digest this. What is your considered vibe opinion on the impact of all of this?
So I'm working on a piece about this as well. So I've been kind of talking to people, and it's kind of an interesting story because there are three different parts to it, right? It's like, A, will it juice turnout in a way that dramatically affects the other 2024 elections, right? Does this put this in play for Biden? Does it threaten Rick Scott, who Democrats have kind of laughably been describing as the biggest pickup opportunity of the cycle as a reflection of just how rough this Senate map is? And, you know, of course, that redounds to House seats to some extent, though Florida is a pretty aggressive gerrymander, so less so than some other down ballot stuff. But that's kind of the pot A. And then pot B is, can you get over 60% for an abortion ballot initiative? And the thing is, you know, abortion rights have won every single time they've been on the ballot since Dobbs, and that's pretty striking. But here you've got this higher threshold, which would have defeated some of those wins. You know, most recently in Ohio, that was about 57%, which is obviously a hefty win, but it's not 60. And you've also got the fact that this is a presidential election cycle, and a lot of these abortion ballot initiatives to this point have been off cycle, you know, whether that be midterms or special elections. Sometimes the special elections are designed by Republican legislators to try to attract less attention. So, and that makes a difference because I talked to one expert who has studied this and found that the turnout boost from a ballot initiative in typical presidential elections is about 1%. Now, of course, we're living in a little bit of a different world where everything abortion is kind of scuttling what we know about politics a little bit. So that might not be as dependable as it is with other races, but that's a big piece of it. In a presidential election, you've got high turnout across the board. How much does a ballot initiative have latitude to change that? Though, as he also said to me, which I think is right, if the problem for Democrats is a lack of enthusiasm, then having a ballot initiative that draws enthusiasm, that's a big deal. And then you've got pot C, which is, if this passes, will it be allowed to go into the Constitution? Will the legislature find some way to, neuter it or make it toothless the same way they did with the felon reenfranchisement amendment? And now on that score, you know, the group that was behind the reenfranchisement amendment in 2018 is the same group that's behind this one. And what I kind of keep hearing in interviews is like a lessons learned thing, right? Like they kind of have this front row seat to see how aggressively the legislators would kind of interfere and defang that amendment. And, you know, you might be thinking like, well, duh, it was going to be aggressive, right? These are Republicans in Florida, which is kind of a cradle for crazy Republicanism. But I mean, like you said in the intro, Josh, the reenfranchisement amendment passed with 65% of the vote. I mean, that is a huge majority, especially with, a crime and punishment topic, which is polarizing. You know, it's not like this was something that doesn't fall flatly on partisan lines. So I think, you know, you couldn't really be mad at them for thinking that if it won by those kind of numbers, it was safe, right? That's a mandate from the people. And it didn't matter, right? Legislators completely defanged it, you know, passed the law that all the fees and restitution had to be paid off first. But, oh, yeah, we're not going to have any centralized system where you can see how much you owe. And by the way, we're going to, you know, let people register to vote, and then we're going to come arrest them with this police force because we were wrong in kind of letting them vote. So, but I just keep hearing like they're paying attention to that. They have contingency plans for everything. And I think the threat here in Bucket C is coming not just from the legislative side, but also, you know, from the legal side. Even when this was at its hearing before the Florida Supreme Court, where Ashley Moody was trying to argue that, you know, this was unintelligible and voters won't understand it and everything, the Chief Justice was like, we know this will be litigated, you know, endlessly if it passes and becomes a constitutional amendment. And
that's interesting. I didn't realize that.
He used some kind of like fetal personhood language in there. So to me, like, that is what makes this story interesting. You've got the will it juice turnout piece. You've got the can you hit 60%? And what does a reproductive rights amendment change about what we already know about how much ballot initiatives can juice turnout? And then see, will this be allowed to be implemented post-passage if it does pass? And what's interesting about that is, like, this ballot initiative could do things that help the left whether or not each bucket of this, you know, is checked. You know, if you're looking at this just from a political punditry perspective, like, you only care about A, right? You only care if it draws turnout, drives turnout to the election, and that's the end of things. But, you know, from the kind of being a human perspective, Florida is the second biggest abortion provider in the United States. And knocking it down to a 6-week ban is a huge deal, not least because where it's geographically situated. Like, think about all the red states that are kind of surrounding Florida that have draconian abortion schemes. And people are already kind of being openly like, there is no way that any nearby state can kind of absorb the patient base that Florida has been dealing with, you know, since Dobbs. So, you know, that's the other angle. There's just like, this is such a kind of huge news on all these various levels.
And where are they now? They're at 15 weeks now?
Or
are they still at the status quo ante?
That's like right. This Supreme Court decision, like, technically was predicated on allowing a 15-week ban, but it basically clears the way for the 6-week ban to spring into effect.
Got it. Okay. And so in your conversations with you know, the people around, mm-hmm. in and around this effort, was part of that renewed focus the actual language that it's written tighter? Or is this just kind of like, we know what's coming, so we're going to have all of our lawyers lined up kind of thing?
Yeah, both and, for sure. There has been like some criticism of how the reenfranchisement amendment was written, kind of like you alluded to, that it wasn't ironclad enough. And again, you know, I don't think you necessarily can kind of blame the amendment drafters, because it is like crazy brazen to take something that 65% of the population or the, you know, the voters wanted and be like, no, we shan't allow that. But also, as was pointed out to me, which I think is an interesting point, like, even if you feel kind of strongly about reenfranchising felons, it's a very kind of relatively small part of the population, right? Like, there is something to the idea that abortion is more ubiquitous in people's lives and that there might be a little less wiggle room for Republican legislators to be like dicks to all women than there was room for them to be dicks to, you know, re-entering citizens who are already such kind of a sidelined and marginalized and maligned part of the population. So I think that plays in as well.
Yeah, I mean, that point is one that has occurred to me at a few different levels. First, on the language, when this first came up, the new abortion, you know, amendment was allowed on the ballot. I went back and looked at the re-enfranchisement initiative or the amendment, and it was pretty, I don't want to say vague, it was clear, but it didn't have those you shall never, you won't, you know, you won't do this, you won't do that, you won't do the other thing, that kind of like, you know, belt and suspenders kind of language. It basically just said, we're not going to do this anymore and be excellent to each other, kind of, you know, it did. And obviously, there's a lot of moving pieces to that. And so it did leave some of that open. Again, that's not a criticism exactly. Everybody knew what it meant, but it did give them some openings. And then on the other point, this whole issue of the how it's one thing to say, okay, 65% of voters were for it, but how much do they care? How much, you know, what percentage of the electorate is it a live or die issue for? You know, another side of that is for the Florida state legislature, you know, how much do they care about re-enfranchisement? They probably care some because there's a shockingly large number. I looked it up. I think it was 10% of, you know, citizens who were otherwise allowed to vote are disenfranchised in Florida because of felon disenfranchisement. That's a stunningly high number. And that number in the nature of things is going to hit potential Democratic, you know, traditionally Democratic voters, poorer people, less white people, blah, 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 blah. It's going to hit them more. But the populations who are going to have a felony conviction overall are going to be ones who are less tied to the political system, not as regular voters. So the point is that the Florida state legislature really went whole hog on something that I think is not at the center of their political identity. So what are they going to do on abortion, which is like the absolute center of the sort of the political identity of many conservative Republicans? That's one side of it. On the other, it kind of, you know, who does it really hit? Well, felon disenfranchisement hits people who can't vote, right? I mean, it's worth kind of pointing that out, right? So kind of like when Florida pulled this, it really hit people who can't vote. I mean, again, I know that's obvious, but let's focus on that. It's people who already couldn't vote. So there was an altruism aspect to that initiative. It's people who can vote be saying, I don't think it's fair that these other people can't vote. So it's inherently kind of limited in impacting people directly who can punish you at the ballot box. So it's, I guess my point is it's kind of different on both sides. And it's interesting with the, you know, it kind of gets into the question of how much should we really entertain as legal questions, things that the Florida Supreme Court might do. But if you have something if you have explicit language in the state constitution that says you can't ban abortions pre-viability, and it's a bit of a stretch to say, well, if you look in the true meaning of, you know, the right to liberty and happiness and blah, 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 that, well, that's more important than this explicit language. On the other hand, who are we kidding? Right? We're talking about a far right wing Supreme Court. So, Kay, what did you hear on the question of, or what did you draw from the conversations you've had so far about the electoral impact? What do people think?
So the big things are, you know, like I mentioned earlier, that one expert I talked about said, you know, you get 1% extra turnout in a presidential cycle versus like 2-3% in a midterm on ballot initiatives, which is not a lot. But as you said, in 2016, it was what, like 1.4 or something. So that's a big deal in Florida. You've also got this dynamic we have to talk about, which is Florida, like many of these red states, has a pretty rich history of voting for progressive ballot initiatives and then in the same breath, re-electing Republicans who work and stand against those issues. I mean, we saw that recently, right? In 2022, when Kentucky voted for abortion rights on the ballot initiative, I mean, Rand Paul was easily reelected, right? So like voters have shown an ability to hold these things in tension and to vote for kind of progressive ballot initiatives when they're not tethered to a political identity, when they don't have a D next to them. But what the organizers and Democrats are kind of hanging their hats on is in places where the candidates running have made the ballot initiative very kind of central to their own campaigns. And the big example everyone keeps pointing to is Michigan, you know, in the wave where you got the legislature, you got the Secretary of State, you got the AG all in one fell swoop, and Michigan enshrined abortion rights in the Constitution. And in those races, they're all pointing to like those people made reproductive freedom a big part of the pitch, right? Like you go to the ballot, you vote for me, you vote for this amendment. We are, you know, we are joined. We are inextricably connected. So they're to kind of avoid the potential that people will kind of go to the ballot and blithely be like, yep, we should protect abortion rights and Rick Scott for another 6 years. There's a lot of pressure on the Democrats to kind of then center reproductive freedom in their own pitches. And that's something that we've seen from the Biden campaign in a way that I don't know that we've kind of seen them react so quickly and so comprehensively to nearly anything. Like the second this came out from Florida, we got statements from both Biden and Harris. We got a leaked memo to NBC about how Florida is winnable and reproductive rights is the centerpiece of that strategy. Even Trump, who like, so bafflingly avoids ever having to comment on anything, was forced into saying, which I think is so funny. Like he got asked about this by a reporter and he said, yeah, we'll have an announcement about that next week, which like totally 50-50. That's real. That's something he just like pulled out of his ass in that moment and never intends to talk about it ever again. But I mean, they pounced, like they made this a big thing. It's really clear that their Florida strategy is going to be heavy on abortion. And you know, in that way, it's kind of like the timing's perfect. There's a ballot initiative that people can go to the polls and vote for, even if they're not that excited about Biden. And then also, you've got a really draconian ban springing into place and making the threat real and actually, not theoretical.
It actually comes into place in May. Like, it wasn't like the day of, right? It's something like a month from now or something.
That's right. That's right.
You know, who knows how these things play out in electoral terms. But it does occur to me that that is potentially significant about the, you know, electoral political impact, that if you have the, you know, the first stories of, you know, 11-year-olds being forced to carry a you know, a fetus that is a product of incest, all those kind of things, if you have those kind of the first ones hitting, you know, over the summer during the conventions, I mean, I don't lose sight of the fact that these things continue to happen in all of these states, right? They don't stop after the first few months. People get used to it, and used to it is a tricky term. It becomes less shocking because people hear it happening again and again. So all of the, you know, who knows how it plays out electorally? I mean, I don't know. I get the sense that, I'm not saying I have strong confidence that it is going to turn the partisan elections in Florida, but I get the sense this is going to be a pretty big deal in Florida, and I don't at all rule out the possibility that it's going to win. I don't know. Florida, I have I'm not an expert on Florida politics, but Florida is not Ohio. It's different. It's very different kind of politics there. Do you remember offhand what there were several different things in Michigan. You obviously had the trifecta. Mm-hmm. You had the Supreme Court. Did you also have a referendum, a ballot initiative? And so what was the percentage on that?
Yeah, 57%.
All right. So that's telling and not necessarily in a great way. I mean, each of these states obviously has a, you know, we think of them as, we boil them down to the difference between being, you know, 2% on one side or the other of the partisan divide, but all sorts of, you know, there's all sorts of different flavors in these different states. But, you know, that's a state with a Democratic trifecta, and they could only get to 57%. So that does sort of remind us that 60% is a real lift. It's a real lift.
60% is hard, and it's meant to be hard, right? Like there's a reason that so many red states have tried to follow in Florida's footsteps here and been batted down. I mean, a supermajority is like, imagine a presidential candidate getting 60%. You know, it's just unheard of, right?
You know, it's funny. I went and looked at what, you know, how that happened, I was kind of thinking, what, did this happen like, you know, 3 or 4 years ago? Well, no. Well, obviously not, since it was the case in 2018. It happened in 2007, which is, you know, not ancient history, but it is before this very recent period where a lot of Republican, hot button Republican agenda items are getting pushed through in red states through the amendment process. So it does precede that by a bit. But the irony is, I think it won by like 57%.
That's right.
Right. And, so it's kind of like, what's that about? Right.
And it came to the ballot because as a result of Jeb Bush fighting a plan to put in high-speed rail across the state. That's what got this onto the ballot, because he defeated that and didn't want any more of this liberal tampering. So it's like,
interesting.
It just kills me that it, you know, it boiled down to make an attempt to like give Florida some public transit. And it was like, we shall never hear from the people again. More of this scintillating content after these messages.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey. Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Back to the show.
It's, you know, it's funny that, so it was kind of, well, obviously it was the same at some level, because why else would you raise it? Clearly you're trying to, you're trying to prevent something, but it almost seems quaint in retrospect, right? The big Trumpite movement against high-speed rail, right? I mean, it really does. Exactly. It's like, the old days when we argued about high-speed rail. So let's talk about the one particular Florida voter. the guy down in Mar-a-Lago. Now we've referred to it a few times already in our discussion that, in response to, I mean, he's getting abortion questions from a million different angles now. And in regards to one of them, he said, well, we're having a statement next week. So look out for that statement next week. And he's been, you know, this whole topic is going to tell us a lot about his ability to be saying everything at once. Because on the one hand, he's frequently still going back in his rallies to saying, I told you I would, you know, overthrow Roe, and I did. I gave you the best Supreme Court ever and all this kind of stuff. And then at other moments, he's sort of denying it. And then his first, I don't know if it was his response. I think it was his response. Like, I don't think it was his voiced response. I think it was a statement in his name put out by his campaign that he said, well, I'm totally pro-life, but I'm so big on states' rights. So if the people want it, let's do it. You know, which is, that's not, that's the concept in theory of Roe, but that's not really what the pro-life thing is about. And now he's, you know, talking about next week. It kind of feels like infrastructure week to me, or, you know, when he's going to release his Obamacare reboot plan or something.
Made me think of that. Always was 2 weeks away for like 6 months.
Yeah, forever. It's like Zeno's 2 weeks or something like that. Yeah. And it shows you, because, as you know, for a while, he was pushing this line about, I'm thinking 15 weeks, but mm-hmm. who knows? I gotta get the feel for it.
And it's 16 weeks, because a round number, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's both, as he often manages to be, it is both offensive and absurd at the same time. I mean, because why this ridiculous pushing 80-year-old philandering, raping, lifetime proficient person is making this decision for women is a bit off to start with, but also that he's doing it on the basis of the feel, right? I mean, what the fuck does that mean? Right? I mean, in theory, maybe you say there's some medical thing. Well, you know, the latest pro-life study has said that the fetuses are against abortion after 10 weeks or something, right? But it's so him to make it about, like, I'm getting the feel for it or whatever. But clearly, I think, as you've said many times on the podcast, people don't like bans. And we've seen a number of times, or let's be a little more clear, sizable majority of voters don't like bans. they'd probably be against a 40-week ban, right? It almost doesn't matter if the ban were higher up than the roast, the effective Roe standard was. A ban is just, it's a ban. And we've seen a number of times that Republicans have tried to get cute on this and say, well, 15-week, it's not even a ban. It's more just, it's just a beautiful number or something like that. But that doesn't seem to work. And so that's why he's next week, 2 weeks, why that's happening.
Totally. And like, I do think it's a fundamental problem for him that no Republican has figured out how to square this circle. And he is under pressure from both, you know, like the left that's going to want to talk about abortion all campaign long, but also from the right, you know, anti-abortion groups. Like, it might be enough for his voters to kind of chuckle to themselves and be like, we know he's paid for abortions, blah, blah, blah. But like, look at the court he did, right? But that's not enough for anti-abortion groups. Like, it's kind of, what have you done for me lately? Like, yeah, they got Dobbs, but they want a federal ban. They want abortion obliterated in the United States. So Trump kind of pussyfooting around with a 15-week ban, which, as we've said before, would only affect, you know, a very kind of infinitesimal amount of abortions done in the country. That's not enough for them.
Statistically very small. Yeah, yeah. No, totally. That's it. It's, it really is. Well, it, and the other, what makes it so, it's just another permutation of what makes it so hard. If you really had a 15-week national standard, that would make the vast majority of current abortions legal. After 15 weeks is when you get into, like, you know, the amniocentesis didn't, you know, there's a problem and there's complications. And I'm not saying that would be good, but it would certainly be a disaster in the eyes of the pro-life movement. Obviously, it's not a standard. It's a limit. So you keep it banned on the red states, and it just only applies to the blue states. But yeah, there's just no, well, and not only do the pro-life forces want the national ban, but they also don't want to see their fancy Dobbs toy disintegrate in their hands, which is kind of what's happening. That I don't think we have seen one of these initiatives fail yet. It may fail in Florida because of 60%, but we're about to talk about a few more states that may have them. And obviously, Democrats are excited to have them during a presidential year. But from a reproductive rights and pro-life perspective, that doesn't matter. What matters is that, kind of like, sure, you're going to hold on to, it's like, what's the guy in the not the Avengers, you know, the guy who disintegrates, right? That's Dobbs. He's like kind of disintegrating in, as we go. And again, it's certainly not happening quickly enough in Texas and Alabama and, you know, all these different states. But again, if you spent 40, 50 years as a pro-life activist trying to get Dobbs, it's quite a bummer seeing this happen. So yeah, they want a federal law.
Right. I mean, and the anti-abortion movement has always kind of dressed itself up in like less objectionable language to be more palatable to people who aren't in its like nutso activist core. And in the case of Dobbs, that was leave it to the states, right? Eminently reasonable. Let each state decide. We don't want to be trampled on by the federal government. But obviously, that was never the intent, right? It's that was the a huge incremental win. And that's what they got from Trump in the first term. And that is not going to be enough in the second term. In the second term, they want, no, we're not going to leave it to the states, actually, unless they want to be more draconian than the federal government, right? I mean, and I think they're being like pretty loud about that. They're not going to let him wishy-washy his way out and be like, well, I gave you these Supreme Court justices. It's like, again, that was our first term treat. What's our second term treat? You know, why are we going to put in all this work to get you elected if you're not going to kind of further our mission? And then Trump is left in this like kind of, as you say, amusing situation where it's politically impossible. I mean, we've seen other Republicans try to do it and fail, find any kind of like median point. And then also, it just, it really is funny that the big anti-abortion president is Donald Trump. Like, yeah, I'm sure his religious convictions are really keeping him up at night on this one.
You know, it's also an example that I think why there was actually a more recent poll out of Maryland that showed Hogan basically tied, maybe a touch behind the probable general, you know, Democratic general election opponent. But even after I think the first poll came out that showed Hogan way ahead, I've been pretty confident from the start he's going to lose that. Partly because he's going to be on the ballot with Donald Trump, and that's super hard. But the other thing is that, I mean, look, maybe this election's going to go really well and Democrats are going to hold on to the Senate. Not impossible, but it's tough. But certainly we are going to go into Election Day thinking that there's a very good chance of a Republican Senate, and that is going to have be around Hogan's neck. And it's also going to be the case that if Donald Trump wins the election and there's a Republican Senate and there's a Republican House, which is certainly not impossible, that on day one, there's going to be a lot of pressure to pass that national abortion ban. And like filibuster, yeah, right. Right. So so the whole election in Maryland, whoever Hogan's Democratic opponent is going to be, you're going to be number 51, dude. What are you going to do? And I think he has said that even though he's pro, you know, even though he's personally pro-life, he doesn't think there should be a ban. That's still a tough thing to bring into an election because there's lots of pro-life Republicans in Maryland. So it is tough. And, you know, one other thing about this, and this is where Mitch McConnell's at least retirement from the leadership, I think, is a pretty big deal, because I think you have Mitch McConnell in there as a majority leader in a new Republican Senate. I think he's the type who says, you know what, just not feeling a filibuster and all this kind of stuff, and I'm not feeling this national abortion ban. Not because he's not pro-life, just because he understands the politics of it and what that means for the next election or anything. But it's not going to be Mitch McConnell. It's going to be a new majority leader, if they have the majority, who is going to be much more of a fire breather and much more owned by the people who've been trying to fire McConnell forever. So this isn't just Democratic scare tactics that they're going to move right to a national abortion ban if they get a trifecta. Whether it's actually going to happen, I'm not certain, because you know, a lot of senators, you got to get every single one to line up. You got to get them every single one to line up to sidestep the filibuster. But they're going to try on day one, because why wouldn't they? Because they're the pro-life party and their movement just spent half a century trying to get Dobbs. And it's already kind of crumbling through their hands.
So we're going to talk about a few other kind of key states that also are at various points in the process of moving towards having one of these, enshrining abortion rights ballot initiatives this cycle. Arizona and Nevada are kind of the most eye-catching ones. Those are both at the level where the organizers say, you know, they have enough signatures to get it on the ballot. And these kind of groups are pretty well-trained at this point for, you know, getting far above the threshold they need. They know they're going to be tossed out. They know, particularly if they're in states that have kind of Republicans in these key roles, that they go to the ends of the earth to make sure that they're solid on that. So obviously those are two big ones. Arizona is Ruben Gallego and Carrie Lake. Lake is already kind of an anti-abortion nutbag, so it'll probably be pretty easy for him to kind of slide this into his extremist pitch that he's already using with her. And then Nevada, Jackie Rosen has been running quite hard on reproductive rights already, kind of making that a centerpiece. And then the other interesting one is in Montana, the state Supreme Court just kind of settled a back and forth about the initiative language. It basically, the court itself ended up rewriting it. So it's not exactly what the organizers or the kind of Republican officials wanted it to be, but they kind of, you know, rewrote the language. So signed off on that. And Montana, of course, is important because John Tester is going to be running the fight for his life. So anything that kind of brings Democrats, yep, or independents or Republicans who aren't anti-abortion to the polls is only a boon for him.
Yeah, I don't have quite good enough a feel for Montana on this question. Montana is a little less Republican than the states around it. Continuing today for the last 15 years or so, all of those states, and when I, you know, kind of you know, the Intermountain, the northern tier of the Intermountain West, you know, all of those states are tend to be very Republican, but also kind of libertarian. And you know, there's it depends on, you know, Wyoming, Ohio, Idaho, blah, 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 the Dakotas. So I don't have an immediate sense of where Montana is, you know, on this question, on the abortion question. It may not be as obvious as we think for what sounds like a pretty Republican state, but I assume all three of those states are 50% states or 51% mm-hmm. states.
Florida is the only one that has a 60% threshold.
Like literally in the whole country. Yeah. So not just the ones that are currently doing these. Yeah, it is. I mean, again, it's sort of, I understand the logic, but it is kind of funny that 50% of voters decided that 60% is needed. I mean, whatever. They could have, in theory, they could have just decided to get rid of the whole constitutional amendment, you know, by plebiscite thing itself. But it's still a little strange. I mean, I certainly think that I didn't realize until the last couple of days that they were as far along in Arizona and Nevada as they seem to be. And that's potentially a pretty big deal. I mean, those are Nevada's. Well, it's hard to say which is more most win. I mean, you know, Biden, you know, Biden could hold the blue wall states and lose all of them. But those are both critical states. Nevada's is critical. They're both very critical states. And they're both, you know, in Arizona, if you have that on the ballot, Carrie Lake is not a good person for Republicans to have on the ballot for the top of the ticket, to put it mildly. I mean, she still thinks she's like the governor in exile and she's, you know, pretty whack and everything. So these things matter. These things really mm-hmm. matter. So I guess we'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It's kind of funny because the Ohio ballot initiative, their kind of whole pitch for putting it on the 2023 cycle versus 24 is because 24 was going to be so crowded with the other ballot initiatives, and they wanted, you know, that kind of like nationally available pot of money to come to Ohio. Which is funny because now I'm all, you know, you wonder if Sherrod Brown is like, ugh, should have just waited. Should have done it in 24.
I'm sure if it had been up to Sherrod, he was never going to have been in a position of saying, yes, we can have abortion rights starting in 3 months, right. But I have a better plan. Let's do 15 months. But I have no doubt that, you know, he would have loved to have it differently. And for a moment, we thought that Republicans might actually give him his wish. Remember, there was that brief period of grumbling where Republicans were sort of like, I don't even remember what their argument was exactly, but just like, either we're going to put it on
do it again.
Yeah, we'll do it again. Or maybe like, well, you know, try to pull a Florida. Well, mm-hmm. maybe we don't have to follow this or something like that. That seems to have calmed down, but I guess we will. I mean, the one that really, they are all equally important, but the one that really interests me, I'd be fascinated to see a poll out of Montana. Like, what is the number?
Me too, because the strategy in Ohio, rather than making it about reproductive freedom, reframing it as, you know, the keeping big government kind of out of your healthcare decisions argument. I mean, that seems like tailor-made for Montana, right? Like mm-hmm. the biggest state of get off my lawn and out of my business type people.
Yeah. And again, it's, I'm trying to remember, I think, what is it? Obama got close in 2008, but lost. I'm pretty sure. I think he lost, but it was very close in 2008. It's the point is, Montana is not Wyoming and Idaho. It's different. It has a different politics. It's a little, I mean, they're all humongous in geographical terms, a little bigger population terms. And I know we have seen that a state like Kentucky is about as ground zero as you can get for the demographics that get you a pro-life electorate. And abortion lost pretty handily there as well. So it certainly wouldn't surprise me at all if the polls show it getting over 50%. But I'm just curious, you know, curious the... curious the details, but I guess we will, I'm sure we're going to be seeing a lot of those polls.
Yeah. So we're going to end with something slightly different here, which is a follow on when we, you know, I worked on some pieces on the site about how the judicial conference, the federal policymaking, or the policymaking body for the federal courts, was putting out this new policy about, hey, we're not cool with this judge shopping thing anymore. It's making us look pretty stupid. So from now on, if you want a national injunction against federal or state action, you need to go through this randomization process. You can't just handpick your judge that you want to give this case to. And more than anyone else, that was about Matthew Kaczmarek, who's in Amarillo, who we've talked about a bajillion times, who has like hand sent a bunch of these kind of anti-Biden administration cases up to the Supreme Court. So the question at the time, and with all the people I talked to, was like, well, this is great. And we're super pleased and we're very surprised because this is not a generally reactive body, especially to criticism. But how binding is this going to be? You know, how are they going to kind of make lower courts do what they want? And it was a hard thing to guess because they haven't done that much in their history. And now Schumer has been like writing a letter to the Northern District of Texas like every month. And this is where Kaczmarek is saying, hey, you should stop judge shopping. Really want you to stop judge shopping. Okay, now the judicial conference says you have to stop judge shopping. So when are you going to stop judge shopping? And the chief judge wrote back and literally said, nah, you know, we talked about it. We just don't want to do that. But
we think
thanks for your letter. Yeah, we're good for now, but appreciate your interest. So they just said, no, they're not doing it.
So does the conference have any ability to really enforce this?
So I basically asked around with a lot of people, and basically they said they could enshrine this into the federal rules of civil procedure rather than just making it like guidance to the lower court. And not to say that people don't ignore those too, but they're more like ironclad and you can kind of use them to like fight a court that isn't complying. And so they could kind of like start from the ground up in that process, you know, submit it to the rules committee and have a public comment period and do all that kind of thing and just like take the text of this policy and turn it into a rule. Or like a couple of people who I've talked to have submitted their own ideas for rules to stem judge shopping. That's like a little farther along in the process. But again, we're back to like, you know, this is the judicial version of Senate brain, court brain, I guess, where you're like, oh, it makes you sweaty and nervous to like tell judges what to do and to admit to any degree that there is, you know, that the judges are fundamentally political creatures and a lot of them are all out partisans, you know, and so it would require like a reaction to the Northern District, right? Being like, well, fuck that. We're in charge of you. We're making this into a rule, which like people have some doubt that the judicial conference like has that kind of spine in them. But, you know, what else are they going to do? I mean, are they just going to let these people be like, absolutely not. Like we love being the right wing litigant pipeline and we're just going to keep on doing it, you know? And this is in such stark contrast with the only real precedent we have here, which is when all those patent cases were going to that one judge who was like, hey, send them to me, guys, send them to me. And the chief judge was like, yeah, we're not doing that anymore. We're changing up our situation here. And so, but here the chief judge is like, no, we're gonna let Maddie Cakes here be a star on the right. You know, we want him to be on the Supreme Court one day. You understand. And so we'll just leave it at that. And, you know, and then Schumer's like, we'll be looking at legislation. It's like, okay, sure. I mean, I was on the Hill reporting on that like probably a year ago. And it was even clear at that time that it wasn't going anywhere. And it's like, I know we have the Republican House. Like, I don't want to pretend like senators have more power than they have. But there was like limited enthusiasm, you know, notwithstanding the kind of institutional constraints of passing legislation now. And it's not like if you're a lawmaker in a split Congress, I mean, that doesn't give you a license to not do anything for those years, right? Like at the very least, you can kind of prep legislation, like get it to the finish line over on your side and then bide your time until the kind of stars align and you can pass it into a law. But like there was not even, apart from like a select few, people were not even really clocking the issue, which is like staggering given how much harm it's doing their political interests.
It's also the case that either the Fifth Circuit or in theory, even the Supreme Court could solve this on their own. because each time he does this, a litigant can go, you could, I mean, they do go to the Fifth Circuit, but I think, you know, as we have seen, the Supreme Court is not bound to saying, oh, all right, we got to let this go through the process. They can just jump down to the trial court level and grab whatever the hell they want, and they've done it. So it is worth adding here that these other players, if they wanted to, which is the real question, could solve this on an ad hoc basis, that every time there's a certainly with Kaczmarek, they could say, nope, we're not doing that anymore. And just jump down and say, like, okay, cool, you've made your decision, but we're not doing a national injunction. So I'm not saying that will happen, but I think it is important to point that out, to put the responsibility where it is. It's not like this one dude in Amarillo or his boss in the district that he's in is just, you know, can't be controlled by anybody, and he's going full YOLO. And even John Roberts is like, what can we possibly do? Right. This is so bad, right? I mean, they could stop it if they wanted. But, you know, the servings are too good, right? They taste too good. They don't want to, you know, this guy's serving up cake. They want the cake.
And like, that's what some it comes down to. Some Supreme Court justices are getting like increasingly pissy about this. I think probably just because they keep having these like terrible cases in front of them. And, you know, there is that dynamic we've talked about before where like they consider themselves to be like gods in American society, right? So like even if it's in their partisan interest, they get offended when there are these like really, really terrible cases that rest on no kind of legal foundation. It's like, you know, we're the big guns, you know, you got to bring your best. You gotta actually try.
Yeah, don't embarrass us.
Exactly. And that's like coming up a little bit more with some of these big decisions that are coming from, you know, Kaczmarek or his ilk. But, you know, by that same token, Gorsuch has been complaining about the kind of rash of national injunctions for like probably 2 years at this point, and has done absolutely jack all about it. So
yeah. Well, I guess you'd need, in theory, I mean, as long as we're playing fantasy Supreme Court, I mean, in theory, you take the three Democratic appointees, Gorsuch and Roberts, in theory, you know, you get an anti bogus national injunction, voting block, winning voting block, in theory. But again, I don't say that in the vein of wishful thinking. I say that in the vein of let's be clear that there are people who have the power to put the brakes on this, and they're basically choosing not to. I mean, I have no doubt if it seems obvious to me that if John Roberts put out a statement that said, I really hope the conference kind of, you know, puts this in black letter, kind of, you know, formalizes this because this is out of control, I don't have much doubt that would probably put a fire under them.
Totally. I mean, and it's also part of this thing of no partisanship of the courts, you know, no politicization of the courts. But like Mitch McConnell came out there the next day to be like, I hope judges ignore this. And a whole bunch of other like right wing, you know, law professors and judges were like, yeah, this is terrible. We should ignore this. I mean, like, it's accusing John Roberts of hypocrisy almost feels like, yeah, the sky is blue. But, you know, if he actually practiced what he preached, he would come out there and be like, Republicans are politicizing this process, right? Like randomization is in the interest of fairness and the interest of having no appearance of impropriety. But of course, you know, that concern only runs in one direction. So,
yeah. Yeah. No, of course. So I guess that is that's about all we have for today. But before we conclude, I want to remind you, we're coming to the end of our annual membership drive. And you know, the last two episodes, we gave you a whole segment on the membership drive, which I'm sure you enjoyed. But the thing is, we're actually doing pretty well. I haven't looked at the counter this afternoon, but this morning we were already at 800 new members. And that's out of our goal of 1,000 new members. So it really looks like we're going to get there. We really appreciate it. We're hoping to get that done this week, you know, by the end of this week. So what I want to do is, first of all, I wanted to thank you because that's a lot of people. And it's going to get, we're pretty confident now it's going to get to 1,000. 1,000 is a lot of people. You know, you put 1,000 people in the Beacon Theater, you've got what? You've got part of the Beacon Theater filled, right? I don't know exactly what it is. But in any case, so we really appreciate it. And if you've been on the fence, give it a try. Go over to the website. If you're only a listener to the podcast, not a reader of the site, go to the website, which is talkingpointsmemo.com. You'll see a bunch of little, you know, signs up for the drive and join us. It's we're doing 40% off right now, so you get a deal, and you support the work that we do. So just a reminder on that, probably the last, thankfully, the last time we'll need to mention it on the pod, because I think we're going to be able to finish it up this week, which is great for everybody involved, including us. And I think that's about it for this week.
All right. See you next week.
Later.
The Josh Marshall Podcast is hosted by me, TPM reporter Kate Riga, and TPM founder, editor-in-chief Josh Marshall. The show is produced by Jackie Wilhelm. Thanks to Why Not Jansfeld for our podcast theme song, and thanks to all our TPM members who make this possible. Rate and review us on Apple Podcasts, and subscribe wherever you listen.